In addition, I want to, at the outset, express a couple of words of Hakaras HaTov. First of all, to, can't hear anything. Can you hear me? You hear me? Yes? Okay. So first of all, at the outset, I just want to express a couple of words of Hakaras HaTov and thanks. First of all, to the doctors of the COVID-19 Medical Advisory Board for the Orthodox community. And I want to acknowledge in particular the presence of, can't hear. You can't hear me?
Am I unmuted now?
Now you're unmuted. You are now unmuted.
I can't hear anybody.
I'm the only one speaking. Can you hear me?
Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Make sure that
I missed
you're,
the whole introduction.
Make sure that you're not like your speakers are not off.
Something I can do. Daniela, can you text me what to do?
He's probably got his speakers off or something.
What do I do? I can't hear anyone.
We can hear. Everybody can hear except you, I think.
That's strange. So mute my audio.
Check that your computer speakers are on. You're now muted. Okay, I'm mute again. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
We can hear you.
Okay, well, I can hear through your phone. So can you keep that on?
Sure. But Yochanan, we could hear you speaking.
Okay, so did Rabbi Shulman give his introduction?
I'm doing that right now.
What's that?
Turn your speakers on. Make sure your sound on your computer is on.
It's on.
Okay, so I can't hear anyone. Would you like me to start?
No.
Rabbi Shulman?
You're going to start.
Yeah. Okay. Please do. Chas v'shalom, I'm not so presumptuous.
Daniela, can you just tell Yochanan to check that his computer speakers are on?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. You're the only one I can hear. I think I'll need your phone in order to hear Rabbi Shulman.
Rabbi Shulman, can you unmute, please, Dr. Silverman? I'll let you know when you are ready to speak. Then you can hear through my phone.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Well, we'll solve that technical problem, but I
lost you. I can't hear anyone.
Maybe his volume is down. You should check his volume on his computer. Okay. So anyway, what I started to say was to thank you to the doctors of the Medical Advisory Board who stepped into a role that the rabbis collectively asked them to embrace, which was to help advise us in terms of how to advise the community on this entire pandemic and COVID-19.
I can't hear anything. I can't hear a thing.
Hang on a second. My apologies.
Rabbi Shulman, can you unmute me?
You are unmuted. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
Maybe try coming back into the
system. Okay, I'll go out and I'll come back in.
Okay. Sorry about that. So anyway, I wanted to thank them for stepping into a very difficult and a challenging role at a challenging time. This is all new. New information, new data, new procedures, new policies, new circumstances for all of us. And we as a collective group of the rabbis, in terms of our role of advising and directing the community, felt very strongly that we were in great need of a collective voice of the doctors of the community to help guide us and in turn be able to guide all of you. So I want to express our Hakaras HaTov collectively to them for stepping into that role. I also want to thank Rabbi Greenblatt for his constant support and coordination and engaging with me in this, in terms of this evening's program, to partner with his community so that we could together hear from the doctors representing the community medical board, in this case, Dr. Hermelin and Dr. Silverman. I also want to acknowledge that both Dr. Hermelin and Dr. Silverman have been at the forefront of this exercise and the enterprise of the medical board and advice to the rabbis, together with a number of others who have really been with us from the very beginning as this process unfolded, and their collective wisdom, training, professional counsel has been invaluable to all of us as we move forward. So all around, it's I don't think we could have achieved what we have achieved, even though it sounds like it's very onerous and difficult and challenging. But I want to acknowledge the fact that fortunately for us in St. Louis, our community has been relatively much less impacted by this COVID-19 virus in has been relative. Sorry, I'm just getting hit with technical support for Dr. Silverman's challenge. Has been relatively safe and protected from the devastating impact of this virus and COVID-19, due to a very large extent to the advice, counsel, and quick thinking and action by both the medical board and the rabbinic community and the community at large to take the steps that we needed to take and to help keep us all safe. And so the purpose of gathering today is really twofold. Number one is to, Yochanan, are you able to hear me now?
I can hear you perfectly, thank you.
Great, okay. The purpose of tonight is really to kind of touch base. Where are we at? Where is the data and the science at? Where is the circumstances in St. Louis at? And then for us as a community, where are we at in terms of what are our next steps and what do we foresee? What do we foresee and where do we go? And there was a lot of back and forth and conversations over the last couple of weeks and discussions. And so we felt that it would be helpful to hear directly from the Medical Advisory Board and particularly Dr. Silverman and Dr. Hermelin, who have been so helpful and at the forefront of that group and guiding it and being the spokespeople for it. And so I'm going to turn the mics over to them. I've set this up in such a way that I'm not going to unmute the mics. I've set them up. There's just too many people on the call to unmute. There's Baruch Hashem, over 150 people, 140 people on the call. I do, however, want to suggest that if people have questions, which I'm sure we will have a chance for questions, some questions were submitted to me in advance, as I suggested by email. Otherwise, we have the chat open where you can chat, text your questions to me. They are anonymous and confidential, meaning the text only comes to me, and then I will convey the questions back to our doctors, and Rabbi Greenblatt is on the line as well. And certainly, Rabbi Greenblatt, if you want to say anything so then I'm going to turn it over to Drs. Silverman and Hermelin, who are unmuted, and they are going to carry the evening forward. So thank you.
Rabbi Shulman, thank you very much for inviting Dr. Hermelin and myself to this town hall meeting on Zoom. I'm sorry about the initial technical difficulties there, but I can hear everyone, and or at least I could hear you. And we appreciate the opportunity to make ourselves available to everyone. There's a lot of information and a lot of material and a lot for us all to wrap our heads around here. I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Greenblatt, who initially asked me to help Dr. Hermelin put together a medical advisory board. And we've, I think, been very successful in putting together a group of distinguished, thoughtful, very caring physicians, three of whom are infectious disease specialists of national and international repute. And so it's a pleasure to be able to work with them. I really appreciate the opportunity to see so many people. It's great to see everyone. I haven't seen in such a long time. I miss everyone very much. I want to apologize to Les Sable that I'm not wearing a bow tie right now. I hope he'll forgive me for that. But I want everyone to know really that our top concern, first and foremost, is the well-being of our community. And I personally daven every day that Hashem grant me the wisdom and sensitivity to carry out this task in the best way possible. And I know that my colleagues on the medical board do so as well. And I hope that you daven for us. I'll daven for us as well. Ben Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I have the sense that many of you feel that it's been kind of the opposite, that it's been kind of more like a pound of prevention and not even an ounce of cure at all. The preventative measures have been, pretty difficult and pretty strict on every level, emotionally, psychologically, economically, socially, for some of us physically, but fortunately not as physically as it has been in other communities. The main message that I really have tonight is, along with the safety of the community, is that we are looking at easing restrictions. And that is really one of our very top priorities right now, is to look at not only what the county is doing, what the state is doing, but also looking at what other Orthodox Jewish organizations have put together, the Orthodox Union, the Agudas Israel, and looking at easing restrictions on both the institutional level of our shuls, schools, etc., but also on the personal level. We understand that there has been a tremendous psychological and emotional impact to remaining isolated from each other. It's been very, very difficult for all of us, for some more than others. And we want everyone to know that we're very tuned into that. We think about that all the time. We've been talking about that issue for the last couple of weeks. And just today, we set up two subcommittees, one to deal with relaxation of restrictions on the institutional level, and the other to look at the more personal and intersocial level, specifically with looking at when we can begin to have families, grandparents, friends start to get together on some level. It's an issue that is extremely important to us, and I really want to emphasize that that is really on the front burner of what we are looking at. So I'd like to take a step back and try to get a little bit of a broader view of the situation that we're in as I see it, and as I think as a spokesman for the medical board, how we are thinking about things. First and foremost, we were really broadsided. All of us were broadsided by this unexpected disease, this unexpected tragedy, on a personal level, on a professional level, economic level, family, community, national, international, you name it. I mean, this was an unexpected event of tremendous impact. And it threw us initially into a defensive posture of trying to ensure safety with not a small amount of fear and trepidation with what could be coming our way, especially as we looked at the East Coast, as we looked at other countries that were being really devastated by this pandemic. So on a very simple level, anytime an event happens, there's a reaction to that event. And the reality that results is a combination, is a product of that event and the reaction. So just very quickly, I mean, we see that in tennis. When the racket hits the ball represents the product of that reaction in terms of its trajectory. And in relationships, we know that when we make a comment to our friend or our spouse, that if they're listening and responsive, there will be a reaction and another comment coming our way, and the reality will be a product of that. So disease is exactly the same. In this particular situation, we have a virus, and we have a patient, you know, an individual who's infected by the virus, and the result of that is a disease. In this case, the virus is called the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and we know a tremendous amount about this virus. We know its size. We know it's about 900 times more narrow, smaller than a human hair. We know the shape of its proteins down to the atom. And if you gave me about 2 hours, I could do a dramatic reading of its entire genome. We know its entire genetic sequence. There's a lot that we know about this virus, and that will help to inform how treatments and how vaccines will be developed. We're beginning to know more about the patient, how the patient who is infected is affected by the virus. And we know that there are certain risk factors that place a person at high risk: age, diabetes, other types of conditions, race. There are a number of things that are on the patient side of this interaction. And then the combination of the virus plus the patient produces the COVID-19 disease. And we're learning a lot more about that disease. It is a new disease. And in fact, this is a new virus. So this is an entity that is always kind of on the move. We're learning more about it all the time. And what we know 1 week or 1 day might change. And as we accumulate knowledge, it informs the opinions that we have about the risk that we are under. And so I think we all have to understand that this is something where, you know, sometimes it seems like no one really knows what's going on. Fact is, we do know a lot about what's going on, but that reality is changing as we learn more and more. We know that this disease can cause everything from zero, nothing, to the common cold, to an acute respiratory syndrome that puts people on ventilators and results in death. I mean, the spectrum of this disease's ability to cause harm is tremendous. And we know it affects multiple organs. In any case, there are things that we know about it. There are things that we don't know about it. And we're trying to marshal all of this evidence that is viral evidence, that is medical evidence, epidemiological evidence. And we're trying to leverage that into some advice that can be helpful in terms of keeping people not only safe, but sane as well. And that is our goal. And you know, with all of the academic information that's out there, it can be very confusing. But there are two points that I'd like to bring out that I think are important, that kind of cut through a lot of the academic mumbo jumbo in talk. And one of those, I'll just formulate as a question, and that is, when's the last time that you saw the flu or automobile accidents overwhelm a hospital system? I've never seen it. I don't think anyone has seen it really in their lifetime that has seen any kind of disease or situation overwhelm a hospital system. And that's related to the exponential spread of this virus. It's a unique entity in that it causes severe disease and it can spread like wildfire and it can overwhelm hospital systems. And we saw that happen in Manhattan. We saw that happen in Brooklyn and in other places. And we were sort of aghast, you know, really to see and hear from doctors on the scene there, to see pictures of bodies piling up, et cetera. And many of us know people that have passed away or their parents have passed away, or we know doctors who have been in hospitals that have been in unreal situations. So this has the potential to overwhelm hospital systems. It's also interesting to me and points to the infectiousness of this disease, and that it has penetrated the White House two or three times over the last week. Now, whatever you think about the White House, I think we could all admit that it's a place where, you know, they're being pretty vigilant about trying to keep this virus away from top leaders. So what we know is that it can overwhelm hospital systems. We know that it is a brilliant, brilliant spreader. It knows how to evade detection systems. It spreads 50% of the time in people that are pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, meaning they don't feel any symptoms. They may go on to have symptoms, but they don't have symptoms. So it's into this environment that we've all been thrust, and we really all have to work together as a community because we're all connected. And the virus is teaching us, I think, something about Achtus, because it really doesn't care. And it will infect as many people as it can, and we need to come together as a community to try to prevent it. And so as an advisory board, we are here to help, we're here to listen, we are here to guide. We do not see our role as dictating personal behavior. That's not what we're interested in. Certainly at the beginning of this, when the risk was great and there were individuals you know, coming from hotspots that were gonna be coming to our community, I feel that, you know, we ended up taking a pretty strong tone, maybe a little bit shrill in some people's opinions. But we really had a danger, a sakana that was heading our way. And the sense is, you know, at this point, we all sort of have a feel that things are sort of we're on the other side of this to some extent. And to some extent, things are definitely getting better. And I know personally, I have a lot of cognitive dissonance when I go outside and it's a beautiful day and you don't see any bodies laying in the street. You know, you're like, what could be wrong? It's hard for us to get our head around this. But we do have doctors in town that are very tuned in to what's going on in our hospital system. This has affected our community, actually our Jewish community. It has affected it to some extent. There have been positive cases in our Jewish community. Fortunately, no one's been hospitalized as far as I know. But what I really want people to know is that we are not here to dictate personal behavior. We are here to guide institutions. And we are here to be available by phone to people who have questions. Whether our advice rises to a level of sakanos nefashos in certain situations, that really is for the rabbis to decide. Whether our opinions have halachic validity to them, I think, is for the rabbis to decide. But what we have, when we look at the board, we have about 200 to 300 years of cumulative experience helping people through difficult medical situations, trying to help maintain hope in the face of challenging facts, assessing risk, and ultimately deciding when the patient is ready for discharge. And on a social communal level, I think that's really what we're looking at as we are looking at getting back to some of our normal activities and relaxing some of the restrictions. It's similar on a community level to deciding when is the patient ready to leave the hospital and what restrictions should they have when they leave the hospital to keep them safe. One analogy would be a cancer patient, God forbid, but their cell count bottoms out and they're susceptible. They're very susceptible to infection. So when do they leave? What is the cell count that they would need to have where we would all feel comfortable that they could go back out into the community? So many of these factors are debatable, and believe me, on the medical advisory board, we do a lot of debating. There is a wide variety of opinion, and we try to come out with a consensus. But we've basically been asked to try to provide these skills to the community with really what is a brand new disease that we're learning about all the time and an unprecedented situation. And we will continue to do everything within our power and with Hashem's help to bring us safely back to the lives that we had before as soon as possible and to whatever extent is possible. And I think that we need to try to see that light at the end of the tunnel. I don't think that we're foreseeing this degree of social isolation, social distancing, really for the long term. There will be variations of it. It will need to be somewhat gradual, but we are looking very hard to find those areas where we can relax some of the restrictions in a safe way. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Daniela, and then we're happy to entertain questions. Thank you.
Rabbi Shulman, I'm so glad that was recorded because that was unbelievable. Yochanan, what do I say after that? There's nothing to say, but I'm very proud to be a part of this medical advisory board. So thank you so much for providing that background and that perspective. Again, just to reiterate that about 8 to 10 weeks ago, we decided to form this medical advisory board for a few reasons. One was I saw that I was going to need some partners to answer questions because very shortly I was bombarded with phone calls and I knew I needed some help. But as well as we needed to create solidarity among the Orthodox Jewish community and asking physicians from many different shuls to join with experts from all around our Orthodox Jewish community was really what we needed to implement guidelines and have all of us together as one people. Because as Yochanan, as Dr. Silverman said, we really have to take care of each other, no matter what shul or what we belong to. So that was the point of creating the Jewish Advisory Board. And two weeks ago, I was driving back from the hospital, and I wanted to share with you, not in an arrogant way, I felt victorious that we as a community came out of Pesach, and that, thank God, we got through it and we survived it. And I think it was from the incredible cohesive undertaking that all of us did, because it was so hard. It was so hard to tell our parents and our grandparents that they couldn't come in to be with us, and our own family that's in St. Louis, that we can't be together. It felt insane, but we got through it, and I think that it protected us. But in the last few weeks, we have entered into a new type of way to protect. We have to think both about our emotional protection and our physical protection. And that's why we're in a new phase of thinking, how do we now create a partial phase process of opening up shuls, getting families back together, but in a protect us, because it is for open up communities, or as we begin to open up businesses and we allow people to come out of the shelter, there is going to be a second wave. We will see most likely an increase in people getting infected. So I don't think, but we just have to continue to be careful, but at the same time, think about how we can get over this, you know, together. So all of us together on the board are working to create guidelines that are going to continue to protect each other. I think that really gone a huge way to think about protecting the people most at risk. Those are the people over 60. Those are the individuals over 60, individuals that have other comorbidities. And so we kind of went a huge effort so that we could protect people at most at risk. And I think that says so much about who we are, what we find important in life, how we want to do anything to save a life, and how much we love each other and we want to protect each other. And I want us to continue to keep that in mind as we move forward, because we're not totally out of the risk right now. We're moving carefully towards the end of the light, but I still want to keep us in mind of thinking about those people that we continue want to protect. That's but at the same time, you know, creating these guidelines in mind that we can start opening up our lives again. So I'm sorry if I sound like there's a duality, but I think that we have to keep in mind those two, a balance in this. And as Yochanan mentioned, we are here for you to answer your questions, to provide you any guidance. We want to be able to move forward together. So, Rabbi Shulman, I'm going to now leave it to you. And I think we have some questions that the community has provided for us.
Correct. So I've been collecting questions. Some people sent me questions in advance by email, and then a bunch of questions have come in through the chat. So I will do my best to kind of summarize. I'm kind of looking at several things at the same time. I'm going to do my best to try to summarize the questions and then get you either of you to respond to them. The first question, I'm going to start with ones that were sent to me by email this afternoon. Number one, can you provide an update on the community? How many cases do we know if we've had? How serious recovery process? And how does that impact our reopening strategy in contrast to other communities that have had maybe more intense experiences like New York or New Jersey?
Okay. Could I take a shot at that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And then Daniela, you can help me out if I miss something here. So our particular community has been very fortunate. I'm aware of one individual that was hospitalized and that was in the intensive care unit and that was on a ventilator for a sustained period of time. I'm aware of a number of families that had infected members, but none of those illnesses resulted in hospitalization. And I think everyone's doing well at this point. I would personally estimate probably 15 to 30 individuals in our community that I'm aware of who have either tested positive or had symptoms that were typical enough to be considered presumptive positives. So our community fortunately avoided much of the devastation that other communities experienced. I would echo Dr. Hermelin's opinion that with Hashem's help and with our actions, we were able to dodge a bullet, essentially. We do know that the virus is all over the country, and we do know that those communities that acted quickly, and we know that those countries that acted quickly fared much better in terms of their statistics. So there's no question that we're in a fairly good position right now. Now, having said that, I think it's important for us to realize that even though we don't see a lot of the disease around us, the doctors do. And when this disease peaked in terms of hospitalizations approximately a week and a half ago, there were over 700 people laying in hospital beds with COVID-19 in St. Louis County and City hospitals. It's interesting, I think, to look at just a few numbers. You know, if you look at the population of St. Louis County, it's about 1 million. And the population of Missouri is about 6 million, 6.1 million. So that's about 16% of the population is here in St. Louis County. If we look at the number of positive cases, which to some extent represents the testing that's done, but if you look at positive cases, there have been about 3,800 positive cases in our county relative to 9,900 cases in the state. So what that boils down to is about 40% of positive cases have been here in the county, despite our 16% population. And if you look at the death numbers, 52% of the deaths of the state have been in our county, compared to 16% of the population. So that means we're a relative hotspot, you know, by a factor of about three or so. And so I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that while our community has been relatively spared, I would say, there are new cases occurring in the county that we live in on a daily basis. Over the last 3-4 days, those numbers of hospitalizations, actually new cases, so to speak, have gone up and down. It's hard to tell what's going on. Hospitalizations overall have been decreasing. And as a board, we've decided that that's really the important metric to look at, is average hospitalizations over a 2-week period to really get a sense of whether this is starting to go away. And fact is, over the last 2 weeks, things have on average, or at least over the last week, things have on average been decreasing. So I think my point, you know, to this question, I hope it's not too long-winded, is that it's true, compared to other communities that were hit hard, we were not hit hard. I think that was due to the actions that were currently in place. And it's also important to realize that while you might not see it, it is out there.
Daniela, did you want to add anything to that? And if you could just comment, I don't know, I think the question was formulated specifically within the context of the Orthodox community, but I don't know if you have any statistics beyond that, just in the Jewish community. Somebody mentioned to me that they heard that there were some deaths in some of the nursing homes from the Jewish community in general. So just wondering if, you know, kind of expand the horizon a bit in terms of how the Jewish community overall has been impacted by this.
Well, I know just looking at the Jewish light, looking at the obituaries, I've seen a number of, a few of my own patients that have passed away, and a number of other Jewish people that have passed away. I think for reasons of privacy and HIPAA, you know, we have not really been privy to everyone's medical situation. So I don't know, Daniela, do you want to add something with regard to that? Was I on there?
Sorry, I'm going to, Daniela.
Okay, I'm unmuted. I'm
just going to leave it unmuted because otherwise, because I've got to do the mute and unmute. So
okay.
Just leave it unmuted.
So I was only counseled about one individual that required taharas for a COVID incident. Because if
how do we
manage patients, or excuse me, deceased loved ones that died of this virus? Do they need special precautions? And the way that we've thought about this is maybe similarly to the way individuals, I'm sorry if this sounds harsh, but the way we may approach an autopsy case. So at this point, we do need to take special precautions. And I've only had to counsel one to COVID at this point. Not to say that there aren't other Jewish people, maybe we don't know about them, maybe they weren't buried in a Jewish way. So I hope that helps to answer the question.
I'm gonna jump to a question that I think is sort of common to a few questions that I've received, and that has to do with the timetable. And I know that Jochen, you spoke earlier about sort of the metric that the board is going to be using to measure the statistics and the data as we move forward, and watching this after we after they open up and see how it progresses. But it's hard to guess, but I'm just wondering if you can put some kind of a picture of a timeline of what you expect to see, or hope to see is probably a better terminology, in terms of a timeline of how these restrictions, particularly the social distancing restrictions, social interactions between families, and even the institutions too, but to more extent, the particular question here was about the interaction between family units or households or friends. If there's some sort of a timetable that you can envision, whether it be to look at the data a week or two after they open up, and then if there's a decline, then to start looking at restrictions. If you can speak a little bit to what you anticipate as a best case scenario timetable, and what else else is in there. But what's our mindset? Where are we hoping to go?
Okay, well, this is really the substance of the discussions that we're having right now. And, it as you said, a best case scenario assumes that the disease, the number of hospitalizations and the disease in general is constantly dissipating. We've decided, along with, most other epidemiology groups, and doctors around the country, that the number of hospitalizations is really the best metric to look at, because it doesn't depend on the number of tests that are being done, and the number of new cases really is, it could just be a function of how much testing is being done out there. So having said that, we know that we can't get out ahead of the municipality and do things that are illegal. We have to wait for things to actually be permitted by the county that we live in. And the county is planning to move into phase one of the opening up process on the 18th of May. And so our general philosophy from the get-go really has been that the government recommendations, the CDC especially, that they have been somewhat insufficient from the beginning. We started off with testing that was defective, and then some recommendations that were a little lax in terms of the initiation before Passover, when this was all starting. And our sense was that we needed some recommendations that were a little safer than what were being proffered by the government agencies. And I think that we're all in agreement with the Orthodox Union and the Agudas Israel that the dynamics of our community demand something that is probably a little more careful than the government recommendations, by virtue of the way we socialize, by virtue of the way we daven three times a day, and our simchas and our multi-generational frequent gatherings, that would really potentially be problematic and make us higher risk. So the county's gonna open up on the 18th of May. We are looking at the 1st of June, which would be 2 weeks later. We're really looking at 2 week increments as probably being a reasonable time frame to look for change. It could be that it would be 2 to 3 weeks. It kind of depends. The data is still out in terms of whether 2 weeks is long enough to see a meaningful change. But we're thinking 2 weeks of consistent decline or in average hospitalization would then put us in a position to move into a next phase of relaxation. And what I would foresee on June number one would be that shuls would open up to some extent. They would look different than what we're used to. There would be a limitation in the number of the people that would be able to come and daven, depending on what the county is placing the limit at. There will be social distancing within the shul. There will need to be masks, at least at that particular stage. The indoor setting especially for any prolonged period of time, is the most dangerous setting. We know that the virus can come out with coughs and sneezes. We know it can come out with talking as well. If someone were infected and they were to get into an indoor room, so the possibility of spread is definitely substantial. And the longer a person is exposed to someone who is spreading the virus, the longer, then the more likely they are to get the infection. So anyhow, we're going to need to accommodate for that. Could there be some checking at the door of a temperature, or could there be some questions that are asked up front? It's possible. We're kind of trying to visualize that right now. So on a more interpersonal level, we're all wondering when we can start to get back together with friends and family and that type of thing. This is all being discussed, and it's not written in stone, but what I could personally envision would be something first in the outdoor setting, as opposed to the indoor setting. I think it would be more reasonable for families, preferably, for example, younger families of lower risk people who have all been feeling well for the last 4 weeks, you know, to get together outside in a socially distanced type of way. That might be something that we determine is reasonable. That would be more reasonable than immediately going to the Shabbos table, for example. I think that we would need to wait another couple of weeks and make sure that things are still trending down before we start to induce enclosed spaces indoors, or before we start to think about our more vulnerable at-risk community members. That might be another two-week period down the line. So it's going to be a graded process of two-week intervals where we are monitoring essentially to see if there's an uptick in hospitalizations. Because if there is, and depending on the magnitude, then we may need to reinstitute some of the mitigation measures that were required to help get this under control in the first place. So in my vision, I could see people starting to get back together in some way around June 1. That's something that I think needs to be the focus of significant discussion. And then if things continue to go well in terms of the virus, see, the fact is that we are bound by some biological realities, and we want to prevent or at least minimize a second wave of infection. Because fact is, if a significant second wave occurs, then we're back to square zero economically and medically. So that's sort of how I would see things at this point. Again, we just put together some subcommittees to direct and a discussion about this, and we're open to ideas. We're hoping this week to try to get some things down on paper. So that's about the best I can do with that question.
Okay. I'm going to put in a request, not to curtail anything that you've said or to shorten it in any way, because I think your the information is extremely important and valuable to us all. It's just that as we are speaking, the list of questions on the chat has grown exponentially, sort of like the virus. And so in order to get through them, as much of them as we can, I'm just going to suggest that we kind of address the questions one by one and kind of just very, you know, as briefly and as we can. But they're important questions, so I'm going to try to get through as many of them as possible. Question here. Somebody wrote that they have a relative in New York who just tested positive for the antibody. She had a bad cold in January, but it appears it was the virus. As a pre-K teacher, she was exposed early on without realizing it. How many of us are in that boat? Will there be broad testing for the antibody in the near future?
Danielle, you want to take
that? A question you want to tackle, or?
Sure. Testing has been a problem throughout the country, and we're trying to ramp that up now. You're laughing, Yochanan, because this is a hard question, right, to answer? I'm supposed to answer it in 30 seconds. So we have now opened up antibody testing at SLU Hospital, and any provider can actually order the test. So I'm sure that also exists with Barnes or BJC or any hospitals affiliated with them. I believe St. Mercy's. So I think I think that getting an antibody test is a great idea if you think you were exposed, if you think you had symptoms. I think if you are one of those people that either is like the example Rabbi Shulman said, or maybe you are the type of person that was sick and didn't qualify, even though you tried to get a test. So this would be the time that you can get the antibody test. The test is great. It tells you that you had exposure. It doesn't tell you at this point, we can't say that it provides you with immunity. It just says that you were exposed to the virus. There is a slight chance that if you're positive for the test, you have a false positive result, which means that there's a exposed. But I say in general, you can go and get this test. It's a very, you've been exposed to the virus.
Danielle, your last sentence broke up. Can I trouble you to repeat that?
Sure. I think that it would be a good idea if you think you are exposed, you can go and get the test. It's orderable and it will tell you that you are exposed to the virus, but it will not tell you if you have immunity to the virus.
Right. And just as a follow-up to that, somebody had posted a question about some of the tests, antibodies developed in Israel or vaccines like technology in Israel. Do we know anything about Israel seems to be on the cutting edge of this in many ways. Do we know anything about some of the international cooperation, whether from Israel or other countries, to the situation here in the US?
Well, my understanding is that the international cooperation, you know, is kind of guided by the, can you guys hear me?
Yep.
I'm kind of guided by the HWO, which is sort of an embattled institution right now. So I'm not really sure how much coordination there is. I've heard a lot of very interesting research coming out of Israel, for sure. There are some potentially some antibody related tests, and potentially there's even antibody related treatment that I'm sure Daniela could speak to. As far as a vaccine goes, I think the vaccine is an extremely important element in this whole process. And what's very interesting with regard to that, there are probably 100 different vaccines that are being studied right now. They're being fast-tracked. And just really quick, it normally takes 5 years to develop a vaccine. And the goal is to develop a vaccine within a year or so and to really run in parallel all the processes that are required to bring a vaccine to market. So in addition to developing a vaccine, it's got to first of all be effective, then it has to be scaled up and manufactured and then distributed essentially around the world to 7 billion people. So it's quite an undertaking. There's a massive effort underway, and that is really what's going to provide a termination, hopefully, to this entire process.
I'm not aware of, you know, there's global collaboration because we have minds from all over the world that are working on this, for sure. From my particular lab in the United States in St. Louis, I don't have German technology in our lab. We're using, you know, American technology. but I do think that, you know, in some way Israel does have some amazing epidemiological data that they've been using, such as they have this very cool app for their phone that tells you if a person nearby had the virus. So I kind of wish we had things like that in, you know, accessible to us. You know, Yochanan brought up the vaccine. Also, you probably have heard about convalescent plasma, which is plasma that's collected from recovered patients. That's being researched all over the world, including in our backyard. So again, I think that this is basically a global collaboration in general.
Okay, thank you. Next couple of questions. Just a brief comment about social distancing and distinction between social distancing and physical distancing. Are they the same? Is there a difference? Especially that dovetails into a question that comes later on, which is the context of if we're still in social distancing, how can we contemplate going back into a shul? Isn't that a contradiction? So if you can kind of, I guess, clarify a little bit about the social distancing parameters and how it impacts gatherings in places like shuls, And I'll add to that the question of, you know, are we contemplating, this I guess is more of a question for the rabbis based on the input from the doctors, are we contemplating things at some point down the road, things like outdoor minyanim rather than indoor minyanim? And that I guess becomes more of a communal policy in terms of the shuls, but and some of that directive is coming from the OU. So we'll let you speak to that now.
I don't
two questions in one.
I don't know exactly who was the first to discover the 6 feet of distance, but very early on we decided that, or someone researched that, a person could get infected from this virus within 6 feet of another contagious person. So social distancing has come to understand that if you've been exposed to someone within 6 feet distance and there's no covering between either person, there's a risk of you being able to contract the virus if that person coughs, sneezes, or even talks, because the virus is transmitted through respiratory droplets for the most part, as we know. We also know that it's possible that it could actually be transmitted from the fecal-oral route. That's something else that we're coming to understand. But for the most part, we're thinking, how do we prevent people from contracting the virus? And so contact is 6 feet, you know, not having protection and being exposed to someone. The thing is that we're also learning that people are most infectious actually a few days before they even start to show symptoms. So that means that a person could be talking and they have virus, they're shedding the virus, and they don't have a fever yet. So we want to be able to protect people even before they know that they've got the virus. So what we're calling pre-symptomatic. So 2 days before you get a fever, or a person gets a fever, they actually might have the virus, and it's not until a few days later fever, shortness of breath come in, but it's already infected another person. So we're trying to think about ways that we can mitigate that infectious, that contagious possibility. And that's where that comes from. So now we want to create guidelines that can mitigate the risk of anyone getting into the shul that may be symptomatic, and then creating a space and a safe space for people to be distanced, socially distanced, so they have a very low risk if there's a chance of someone having disease to contracting it. Yohanan, I'll allow you to continue.
If I could just briefly just add, the way I like to think about it is that the ideal state is for a person to have a bubble around them. And that bubble is kind of their space, their Dalet Amos, so to speak. It's interesting that Dalet Amos is about the same as 6 feet. But that seems to be the space, even though we know that if someone sneezes or coughs and they don't have a mask on, that can travel much farther than 6 feet. And some of the virus can be suspended in the air for a period of time in indoor settings that are poorly ventilated. Most of the virus falls as aerosols onto surfaces within a 6 feet radius. So anyhow, if a person can imagine that they have a safe space of 6 feet around them, that's what social distancing is. And I think social distancing is really the same as physical distancing. I don't know what the difference between the two really would be. I think they are synonymous. And it is also something that could change over time. You know, as we get further along and in different settings, it could be that social distancing could maybe drop to 4 feet or 3 feet or something like that. But as we are right now, I think it's important also to recognize that masks are an important complement to social distancing, because we're trying to maintain the integrity of that 6 foot bubble around us, and we're only letting people into that 6 foot bubble if we're in the same household and basically have the same exposures as our family members who are in the same household. Whenever someone from outside of that enters that 6 foot bubble, they potentially put us at risk as a potentially asymptomatic carrier. So that's sort of where the concern front comes from. And the mask, really, it's important to know that there are two types of masks. One mask protects the person from getting infected, and that's basically the personal protective equipment that is used by healthcare workers in hospitals. Then there's the masks that everyone in the population is asked to wear when they're expected to be around people. That mask that you're wearing doesn't help you. It doesn't help you at all. It helps the other guy. And the mask that the other guy is wearing is the one that helps you, right? Because you need to be protected from him coughing and blowing all this virus out. And there's billions of viral particles that come out with every cough. And so that mask that you're wearing is protecting the other person, his mask is protecting you, and ultimately it's reducing the viral particles that are floating around out there. So that helps to also to maintain the integrity of that 6-foot bubble that we want to keep around us right now.
Okay. Next question, again, is kind of a multi-part question, but what are we learning from the experience of Jewish communities in Milano, Madrid, Zurich, government of Israel, about what options are, quote, of new normal? Will we have to adapt to, not only for davening, but also in particular for the schools? There's a lot of ideas and examples in other countries, China, South Korea, may give us a head start. I know there's a lot of articles that have been published to this effect. And I know that at some point or another, the advisory board will address the school issues as they move forward. But I'm wondering if you can comment briefly on what we know from other communities, what's worked, and what long term the kinds of things we might be seeing.
Danielle, let me take a stab at this first, if you don't mind. We're looking very closely at other countries, at how they've responded, and how they're emerging. I do know that we're a little closer to Israel than we are to South Korea, just as a community. So we'll look a little closer at them. And they have begun to resume minyanim outdoors, I think less than 19 people with social distancing. We're looking very closely at those type of options. And they're very appealing as ways for us to get a start. And we're also looking to see whether the infection rates in those places are increasing. Fact of the matter is, in South Korea, they relaxed a lot of their restrictions, and they just had to clamp down in Seoul, in their capital. I think most of the entertainment district, they opened up restaurants and bars and stuff like that, and they saw a big uptick in cases, so they had to clamp back down. We don't want to have to do that. Milan in Italy, obviously the most wealthy part of Italy. It's amazing. I think their healthcare system is as robust as the best in the United States. They got hammered over there. We're looking at how what kind of things that they're doing to emerge as well. So without getting into a lot of the details, you should know that we're looking at these other places. We're very interested in what they're doing and whether they're successful or not.
100%. Following these countries, they're way ahead of us in terms of timing, watching how they've handled things on a public health level, both in, you know, protecting their people, how they're testing, how they're creating guidelines. We're looking into all of those things and trying to apply them to our community.
Okay, next two questions both pertain to kind of the medical side of this virus. If you could elaborate a little bit on the nature of the risk to those over 60 besides the underlying medical issues, or 65, I've heard different numbers thrown around, as well as what are the doctors saying about new findings in New York that a number of children have been supposedly over the virus are later being hit by serious symptoms like blood clots, etc., sort of other, you know, even those who survived the disease, sort of long-term ramifications that it has for them. We keep hearing about the rate of deaths, but what about sort of the impact that it has in general on people who contract the disease and what we know about that?
I'll try to answer that. I think that we should start thinking about COVID-19 as not a respiratory disease, but it can be a systemic disease, which means that we see that it can affect many different parts of our body, including the skin. It affects neurologically. It could cause, like you were saying, blood clots, and it could cause renal disease. And then we know it could cause respiratory and even could cause heart failure. So for sure, you know, these are the differences in the way that we see patients coming into the hospital and having extended prolonged symptoms. They can range from respiratory, all the way to having clotting disorders. Touching upon the children's illnesses, we don't really have enough data to say that this is that it's causing major disease in children. Some things have recently come out that it's causing an inflammatory disorder similar to something called Kawasaki disease. Maybe others have heard of that, but I'm not sure we have enough cases to really say that this is significant disease. As far as we see that the virus really doesn't cause major disease in children, and I think that that's a point that is going to continue to evolve. Our knowledge is how this affects our children, how children carry the virus. Many of them are asymptomatic. And what kind of threat do they have in causing other people to get it? I think those types of questions continue to evolve, the answers to that. Yochanan, what else could you add?
Just real quick, I just think it points to the fact that we're learning more about this disease all the time. Here we are, 4 months into this disease, and we're just learning now that children can be affected by this potentially very severe illness that resembles Kawasaki disease. Now, they mostly do well, but they become very sick. And it's something we didn't really even know until a couple of weeks ago. The other thing I wanted to add was with regard to the at-risk patients, those who are over age 60, 65, who have underlying medical conditions, that really those patients experience a more severe COVID-19 disease. And it's more severe in almost every way. Their morbidity and mortality is much higher. And when you look at the number of deaths, it's concentrated among those who are certainly over 85, but even those who are over 60 and 65. And we all know cases as well of patients who are more middle-aged, who are in their 40s and 50s, like Ellie Beer, for example, who's the head of Hatsala, who was on a ventilator for over a month in Miami. This can affect all ages, but the point is that those who are older and who have underlying diseases, which are quite common, I mean, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, obesity, these things are incredibly common in our community and also in the community at large. And that's why we have to protect these patients, these people, these individuals, because if they do become infected, their chances of having a very rough time of it is much higher.
Okay, next question is a complex question with statistics. I'm going to try to distill it down to its core message. If the goal of this from the outset was described in some of the media reports and some of the discussions that we had, was to, quote, flatten the curve. Ultimately, flattening the curve was designed to not overwhelm the healthcare system. It wasn't necessarily designed to ensure that each individual person was not necessarily infected, because at some point that's going to get out, but to ultimately protect the healthcare system, to treat everybody and that way avoid unnecessary deaths in this context. Based on that, as well as the recent figures published with regards to more widespread testing, what do we know today in terms of, is really all of this still necessary? Are we not on the other side of that flattening the curve? Have we not successfully or maybe even necessarily gotten to where we're at today? So I wonder if you could comment on that.
I'll get started with this. It's true that flattening the curve was designed to avoid overwhelming the hospital system. Flattening the curve, however, doesn't mean that the total number of people getting sick is necessarily less. It means that it gets sort of smeared out over a longer period of time. If we were to stop doing it, but we have to understand that what accomplished the flattening of the curve was the social distancing, the mask wearing, shutting down, unfortunately, the economy and minimizing the opportunities for virus spread. So if we were to sort of just do away with all that right now, there is no reason to think that there would not be a second wave that could be even as substantial as the first, could maybe even combine with the flu in the fall and be a massive second wave with a double infection. So the basic answer is that this is an exponential process. So if we were to try to achieve herd immunity, which I don't think is a very dignified term, I'd like to say population. When speaking about other Jews, we'll say population immunity, not herd immunity. But population immunity certainly could be achieved. Maybe it could be achieved over the next few months. But the cost of that in terms of lives would be very, very high. It might not be a lot higher than it will eventually be over however long it will take to get a vaccine, but it does run the risk of yet overwhelming the hospital system again and causing a tremendous amount of carnage over the short term. So I don't think anyone is really advocating that, at least on a national level. I believe that some of the Scandinavian countries like Sweden and maybe the Netherlands have tried this. Their numbers do not look much better than other places that have instituted this, which I guess you could wonder, well, maybe if it's all the same, maybe we should just do that. Fact is, I think some of their numbers are a little worse, but in general, kind of going for this population immunity by just throwing caution to the wind and going back is going to generate a whole lot more disease. Then we get into issues, how do we protect the vulnerable people among us? I think that could be pretty disastrous.
Okay. Daniela, did you want to add anything?
I think just to reiterate, we did flatten the curve. So I think that was the question. Did we do that? And we did. But by doing that, we may be extending our time. And we want to, again, mitigate any risk of getting. Also, we want to continue to protect the people that are most vulnerable. So I just want to reiterate what Yohanan said.
Actually, if I could just add, if we continued with the mitigations that we have, or if we even cranked them up higher, if that were possible, psychologically, economically, if it were possible, we could make the disease go away. Because the reproduction rate, or R0, we talk about, would be less than one, and the disease would go away. Fact is that we're not really capable of doing that economically or psychologically for that matter. So we cannot drive that reproduction rate indefinitely down towards zero. But we could make this go away with the current mitigation measures that we have in place.
And testing. If we were to do that testing and really isolating people with symptoms.
This question, I think, is a little bit more directed to the rabbi, so we're going to let a few feel free to kind of chime in as well. If you I would need to unmute you, so hang on a second, I will do so. The Agudas Israel of America has put out a directive put together with infectious disease doctors, which outlines the phases of reopening communities. So has the OU, I will add to that question. Why do we have to reinvent the process? Why can't we follow the guidelines there? I have my opinion to that question, but I'm going to defer.
I think that
go ahead.
Those do form, we want to utilize those as much as possible. I agree, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. But even those recommendations themselves say that what they're proposing is some core values, some core recommendations that all have to be tailored to the individual community. We're a community that is not like Lakewood. We are not like Borough Park. We haven't been hit as hard, but neither are we, we're not like Yuma, Arizona either, I mean, we have our own unique situation. We have our unique shoals as well. The Aguda is not the same as Tick, is not the same as the city. So there's a lot of individual tailoring that needs to be done and fine tuning of these very comprehensive recommendations.
Okay. Robert, did you want to add anything to that?
No, once I'm unmuted, it's hard for me to stay muted for too long. So thank you for unmuting me from my shoulder. I just wanted to thank Dr. Silverman and Dr. Hermelin for their time and their ongoing support and guidance over the past 2 months. They've been a godsend to me personally and things that I'm dealing with at our shul and beyond that. So Yochanan and Danielis, thank you so much. And I wanted to say that publicly. I thought that we were following basically the model of the OU, to some extent, National Laguna, even though they are different in a certain way. We won't get into the technicalities now, but I think that the Medical Advisory Board has agreed to, as Dr. Silverman explained earlier, to allow us to still stay in the same mode for 2 weeks following the opening of the communities from the government standpoint. This will give us a chance to be able to, track what's happening. And again, just to appreciate the fact that the way we live our lives in terms of coming together, being together in shuls and schools and social functions and families, it really requires us to be more vigilant than the community at large. That's the opinion of those doctors that are advising National OU. I was on the conference call last week with Dr. Fauci, and it was very informative. And so to answer your question, Rabbi Shulman, or the question you put to the panel, I do think that we're patterning our approach after the OU and to some level National Laguna.
I'm going to exercise my discretion as a moderator to acknowledge the fact that both Dr. Hermelin and Dr. Silverman have put in an extraordinary amount of work and time in a full day. And I know that, I don't know about Yochanan, but I know that Danielle is at work tomorrow. So I think we've been at this for an hour and a quarter. I'm going to suggest that we're going to hold it now. There are quite a number of questions still on the list. And what I'm going to suggest, if you don't mind, is I will take those questions, summarize them, and forward them to both Dr. Silverman and Dr. Hermelin, and maybe get them to respond to them in writing, and we can kind of figure out a way to disseminate that together with this recording. That way, at least some of those questions will get heard.
Rabbi Shulman, I'm sorry, but I failed to thank you first and foremost for hosting this meeting and the role you and Young Israel are playing. It's wonderful to have this forum. And you are great at Zoom. I'll call you the Zoomer Rebbe. And you've taught me a lot about Zooming. I'm still learning, but thank you for this evening. It's been very informative. I appreciate it.
I learned a new word this week, Eiskezum.
Eiskezum.
All right. Thank you very much to everybody. Thank you for your participation, for your patience. Thank you to Dr. Hermelin, Dr. Silverman, Rebbe Greenblatt, and our communities. And all of the other doctors who are on the call, thank you for your work on the board. And again, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers on the call. And thank you all, Yasher Kochachem. And we should all continue to stay healthy, to stay well, and to stay strong.
Thank you. Amen. Amen. Thank you. Thank you.